This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
While Washington spins, here is the real alert. We may be in a rapid shift of warming on Earth. It is very serious. Australia has been hit with yet another summer from hell. The government warns citizens to stay inside as temperatures went over 45 degrees C, 113 degrees Fahrenheit, in parts of New South Wales, South Australia, and Victoria. As reported in the Big Wobble blog, in the South Australian town of Port Augusta, temperatures hit 48.5 degrees C on Tuesday, the highest since records began in 1962. That's about 122 degrees Fahrenheit. According to the country's Meteorological Bureau, the past 4 days are among Australia's top 10 warmest day on records. It's cooking down there. Bats and birds are dropping dead out of the sky from the heat. Millions of fish died, crops are damaged, and more humans will die from heat. Here in the Pacific Northwest, December was 3 degrees C, over 5 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than normal day and night. It hardly went below freezing. The U.S. South and East have been battered by storm after storm, as has California. The polar vortex split, spattering bitter cold into pockets around the world. We are in climate disarray. I am on the phone with scientists trying to find out why things are jumping instead of ramping up more slowly. Last week, I covered new science titled Global Warming Will Happen Faster Than We Think. Grab that from my website at ecoshock.org if you missed it. This week, I talk with the lead author of that paper, Yang Shu. We zero in on the way a cleanup of air pollution, particularly in China, may be now revealing hidden heat built up over decades of fossil fuel emissions. Later in this program, we will explore the way warming makes big droughts worse with scientist Julio Herrera Estrada. But first, we get a briefing from Eric Rigno, senior research scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab and one of the top ice experts in the world. Eric has more staggering news, this time from Antarctica.
Radio EcoShock.
Here is the latest shocking headline in this age of climate change. Antarctica losing 6 times more ice mass annually now than 40 years ago. To explain the breaking science, we are joined by Dr. Eric Rigno, Chair of Earth System Science at University of California, Irvine, and Senior Research Scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. Eric Rigno, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
Just 10 years ago, we were told, don't worry about Antarctica. Sea ice there was actually expanding. We thought snow was piling up deeper in the interior of the continent. How did we get from there to your new results published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences?
Well, sort of 10 years ago, we had already indications that some significant changes were taking place in the Antarctic. I think the light turned on about this about the mid-1990s, but it took more time to collect more data and understand what we were seeing better in order to come to a firmer conclusion. What you mentioned in terms of snowfall accumulation in the interior relates to old climate models that represented Antarctica as a sort of a sluggish mass only responding to change in snowfall, which were predicted to increase because of increased evaporation of the surrounding warmer ocean. What we found in the last 20-plus years is that the glaciers draining the ice from the Antarctic continent are responding to climate forcing. They're responding in a stronger way and in a slightly different way than what was anticipated.
And in 2014, you and your team said that some of the melting in a section of West Antarctic ice sheet was, quote, unstoppable. Can we now say that about other parts of Antarctica?
I think one of the highlights of this study is that there are other parts of Antarctica, especially in East Antarctica, that seem to be vulnerable and are changing slowly right now and potentially hold more sea level rise potential than the West Antarctic part that is slowly falling apart right now. So it's sort of a suggesting that more of the Antarctic continent is at stake than what we thought some years ago.
At the other pole of the Earth, Eric, the Arctic has been abnormally, unbelievably hotter. Has the same thing happened in Antarctica, and is that the cause of the increasing rate of ice loss there?
Yeah, so that's a very good question. Both Greenland and Antarctica are actually mostly reacting to a change in ocean heat along the periphery of the island or the continent. In addition, in Greenland, of course, we have very warm air temperature that increased the melt of the ice sheet. In the Antarctic, the air temperature has not risen to the point where we melt the snow and ice. And in fact, Antarctica as a whole has not been warming up as fast as the rest of the world, whereas Greenland has been warming at 2 to 3 times the rest of the world. So situations are a little bit different, but the processes that are conducive to the disappearance of the land ice are similar. They are related to more warm ocean waters in contact with the ice sheet. So I could explain to you a little bit what's happening in the Antarctic if you're interested.
I'm very interested. Please do.
So what's happening in the Antarctic is that the wind regime around the Antarctic, the westerlies that circulate clockwise around the Antarctic, if you're looking at South Pole, have increased in strength over time and markedly since the 1980s. They do that because Antarctica has not been warming up as fast as the rest of the world. So the temperature difference between Antarctica and the warming world has increased, and that results in stronger winds circulating around the continent. So not only these winds are getting stronger, they're contracting towards South Pole. And as a result of the Coriolis force, these winds tend to push the surface waters to the north, which in part explains the slight expanse of the sea ice. And to compensate for that, they push the subsurface waters to the south. And in the polar regions, the heat is not at the surface. It's below the surface, several hundred meters, where the water is warmer and saltier. That's why it's stable there. And that salty and warm water is able to melt the glaciers around the Antarctic much faster than it did in the past. And that is conducive to the glaciers accelerating into the sea because they feel less resistance to flow when they come to the coastline. Some of the plugs in front of them have been removed by the ocean, and they are able to flow slightly faster.
And your paper mentions the ozone hole as a contributing factor. Why is that?
Yes, strangely, the ozone is also a participant. The disappearance of the ozone layer is resulting in a cooling of the stratosphere in the Antarctic because you don't have as much interaction between the ozone and incoming UV radiations from the sun. So that contributes also to the fact that the Antarctic is not warming up as fast as the rest of the world. Another factor that we should not forget about is that the snow fields, the snow cover in the Arctic is reducing very rapidly. The sea ice, as we know, has been reduced in a spectacular fashion. So as a result, we're replacing a very highly reflective surface in the Arctic by something that absorbs the solar radiation more. And as a result, the Arctic is warming a lot faster than the rest of the world. In the Antarctic, we don't have that. The Antarctic continent is almost as vast as before. The snow is not melting. The sea ice has not been retreating very rapidly. So in terms of the radiation budget, how much heat is absorbed by the Antarctic from the sun, there's been very little change compared to what's happening in the Arctic.
We don't get a lot of news from Antarctica, but when we do, it's often about huge ice shelves falling off West Antarctica, like the Larsen B many, many years ago. Are those really important events?
Yeah, they are very significant events, especially the Larsen B event that you mentioned, because prior to this event, there was still a little bit of debate in the community as to whether this floating extension played any role in buttressing, in holding back all the land ice from the Antarctic from spilling out into the ocean. So when we saw the breakup of Larsen B, we looked at the glaciers upstream of that ice shelf to figure out whether they would speed up or not. And not only they sped up, they accelerated by a factor 3 to 8 in a very short term period. And we are now 17 years later, and these glaciers are still flowing 3 to 5 times above their prior speed, which shows that the change in that part of Antarctica was irreversible and unstoppable.
So West Antarctica is the sort of point that heads up towards Chile and Argentina, but the large part of the continent is East Antarctica. Have you more to report in this new paper about that part of the South Pole?
Yeah, so the traditional view on East Antarctica, which is, as you said, the largest share of the Antarctic continent, is that it sits higher. It's higher in elevation. It sits on bedrock that, for the most part, is above sea level, whereas West Antarctica is grounded on bedrock below sea level. That's why we call it a marine ice sheet. So the prevailing view on East Antarctica is that it's not vulnerable to change. It's as cold as can be, and nothing can perturb it. Most of the changes that we see in East Antarctica, however, are along the coastline. And as I said earlier, the surrounding ocean plays a very important role in the evolution of these glaciers. And they are the sort of knobs that control how much of that ice in the East Antarctic plateau is able to spill out to the Southern Ocean. And we found that these knobs have a few leaks in them.
And after an exhaustive survey, you found in the 1990s, ice loss from Antarctica more than tripled from the previous decade, and it's gone up again every decade since. Is there a way to predict that rate of loss for the next few decades?
Well, that's sort of the ultimate goal of all these studies, besides detailing exactly what's happening to the polar regions and understanding the physical processes that control the evolution of the ice. We want to put that new knowledge, new understanding of the evolution of the ice into numerical models, sophisticated numerical models that include not only the ice, but the surrounding ocean, the atmosphere, the winds, so that we can make a more reliable projection of sea level in the future. So right now, the projection that we have I would call rather primitive because they don't include all the key components, and they are also conservative because they do not represent the vector of very rapid changes in the Antarctic, which are the glaciers. And most of what we're seeing today says that the glaciers are the vector of the mass change in the Antarctic. So until we have a very reliable description of what they do in these models, the projection of sea level rise from the Antarctic in the future should be called into question and be considered as conservative as to what may happen in the future. Now, as glaciologists, we don't want to tell the public what a conservative scenario might be. We would like to be able to inform them about the worst-case scenario, because in the case of sea level, you just want to know how bad things can be rather than some middle range raise of sea level.
And do you have a guesstimate on what that might be by the year 2100? How much will we get?
Well, we are right now, if we look at the rate of increase of the mass loss from Greenland, from Antarctica, and from all the mountain glaciers around the world, and if we add up the thermal expansion from the ocean, we are on a pace that is going to take us to 1 meter sea level rise by 2100. It is likely that the pace of decay of the polar regions will probably get higher than that. We've only seen sort of the beginning of the decay of the polar regions. But that also depends on what we do with our climate system. Not the whole history of the 21st century is written in stone yet. The next 20, 30 years are probably written in stone. But what's going to happen after that depends also on how we control climate warming.
Eric, what will you be working on next?
We continue our work in Greenland. I think my main focus in the coming years is to gather more data around the Antarctic, and especially in East Antarctica, so we can make timely and solid progress in constraining the evolution of this part of Antarctica, so we can put that knowledge in models and improve the reliability of these models at projecting what's going to happen in the coming decades. This way, the public and policymakers will have more solid data in hand to make the right decision for our future. In the meantime, I'm still keen to convey the information we gather from satellites and airborne platforms and other means to the general public so that they stay informed of what's going on right now and hopefully appreciate that we have a serious problem in the polar regions that's going to affect all of us.
Well, I'll put some links to this new science and more about how to find out what NASA is discovering in our weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. We have been talking with Dr. Eric Rigno, head of the Earth Sciences at University of California, Irvine, and senior research scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab. Eric, thank you so much for this briefing.
You're most welcome.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You have seen pictures of crowds in Chinese cities with masks over their faces. The smog of rapid industrialization is thick, but Chinese authorities are working overtime to clear the air. But will air pollution get better or worse in a hotter world? Could cleaner air actually heat the planet? It's difficult to get the latest on the situation in China, but we have reached one of the best young scientists working on it. Dr. Yangyang Xu was educated in Beijing. He came to America to study with the legendary Ram Ramanathan at the Scripps Institution in San Diego. Now Yangyang is an assistant professor at Texas A&M University. He has already published 30 papers with more in the works. Yangyang Xu, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. Hi, everyone.
I want to begin by saying this discussion is not against China. I mean, air pollution is a problem well known in many countries, and Chinese authorities, as I say, are struggling to resolve it quickly without damaging the economy, and this science is part of that. So let's start with some basics. We know what the global average for carbon dioxide pollution is in any year. Is there a similar global count for aerosols, or is that pollution so regional that a global number is not helpful?
You're actually very right on this. CO2 measurement is easier to take because CO2 has a much longer lifetime. So any places, if you take measurement of CO2 concentration, it won't be very different. But the aerosol is exactly the different. It has much shorter lifetime. So region to region, the concentration can vary by many orders of magnitudes. So you have to be taking very local measurement to get accurate numbers. There has been a lot of effort into this, especially in developing countries such as China and India, to build intensive network of air pollution measurement, both for particulate matters, the hazy picture you have pointed out, and also the gas components. We have much better understanding of this problem than 5 or 10 years ago.
On this program, we had an expert tell us that some of the snowmelt in Colorado was happening earlier because of soot that was arriving from Asia. Can it really travel that far?
Oh, yeah. When I say the shorter lifetime, I really mean 5 to 10 days. So if there's a right storm track system during that time frame, it can well carry as well as the dust emission from Asian desert all the way across Pacific and into Western United States and also Canada. So that has been documented in many studies from satellite images. And also we can use numerical models to tease out the exact pathway of those transport. And the downstream effect to the mountain snow melting is, of course, less clear, but there are also emerging evidence suggesting when those soots get deposited over bright snow. Remember, soot are very black. So once they get removed from the atmosphere and deposited over snow, it will darken the snow surface and make the snow melting faster and earlier in the season. And I have published papers on this problem, but for Himalaya regions, which is more prone to local air pollution issues from both South Asia and East Asia portion. And we have well documented the long-term snow retreating trend in the last 30 to 50 years is partially coming from greenhouse gas warming globally, but also from the regional air pollution issues. And the relative contribution is almost the same.
Now, in a series of papers, you and your colleagues have investigated the behavior of air pollution in a warming world, and some of what you found is not what I expected. Could you describe those relationships between a hotter planet and the smog that we produce?
Yeah, there are two issues here, which is wrapped into the problem of the interaction of global warming and the air pollution. By interaction, I mean air pollution can lead to less or more global warming. And the second half of this problem is global warming can also intensify or reduce air pollution. So let me explain the first part. We have all known the dominant cause of the global warming is from greenhouse gas emissions. But at the same time, those chimneys producing greenhouse gas are also emitting air pollution, such as particles. And most of the particles are reflecting solar radiation back to the space and therefore cooling the planet. So those are exactly offsetting the global warming effect. But of course, overall, global greenhouse gas warming is larger. That's why we have observed long-term warming trend in the past century. But the problem is we could have experienced much more warming if we have not produced air pollution problem along the way, which means part of the global warming has been temporarily masked by air pollution from certain countries. But looking into the future, that trend will be well reversed due to the issues you have touched on, the health concerns, the visibility concerns in those regions, and the countries are taking fast actions to solve those issues. So if the air pollution problem will be quickly resolved in the next 20 or 30 years, that will contribute to a net warming instead of a cooling in the past. And that net warming will add on to any additional greenhouse gas warming. So that will bring us a much difficult problem to deal with in terms of adapting to climate change problem at a local scales. So that's the first part. I can explain more on the second part, but if you have question about the first half, I can further elaborate.
No, I think that we have talked about that on the program, how global dimming, as it were, can cool the planet, and we could be in trouble if we actually clean up all the air. We could go, I've heard figures from half a degree to 0.7 degrees warmer if the air was actually clean, and we'll talk more about that as we go along, but I am interested in the second part. For example, in January 2019, you co-authored a paper predicting worse pollution for East China due to increased greenhouse gases. So I'm left with the question, how can haze get worse even as the government tries to clean the air up?
Yes, let me explain on that. This is a trickier question, actually a very concerning one in my personal opinion, which is global warming can actually make air pollution issues worse by itself. So we all know the air pollution issue is coming from large emission, dirty emission, but also it's governed by meteorological conditions. Certain meteorological conditions can keep the particle emission longer in the atmosphere and make the concentration higher, which is affecting human health. But certain weather conditions, such as heavy rainfall or stronger wind, those can help remove the air pollution or dispersing air pollution to a different region to help the local air pollution problem. What we have been studied using global climate model is the future global warming, mostly coming from greenhouse gas, will actually make the meteorological condition worse to remove air pollution from the atmosphere. This meteorological factor is working against local action to cut emission. I'm not saying the local emission is not working. I'm just saying the meteorological condition is doing the opposite to the emission cut, which actually means you need to cut more than you have planned to reach certain air quality goals than what you have expected, because global warming will not help you in this regard.
So I'm just going from memory here, but I recall a talk in a video in the early 2000s by Ram Ramanathan, and I believe he said that evaporation of water from pans, a really old way of measuring the amount of sunlight reaching the earth, it showed a decline of about 9% in the amount of sunlight reaching the ground in eastern China. Does that match up with later research that you've done?
The long-term dimming trend due to air pollution will definitely cause a local evaporation reduction. But at the same time, global warming will cause ocean warming and the surface evaporation enhancement. So those two factors are competing, and it's unclear which one will win eventually. But so far from now, I have not looked at the observational record over China closely to have the updated numbers. What we have been argued to explain the global warming effect on air pollution is overall the evaporation and the precipitation will increase because of the global warming, but that precipitation increase will mostly concentrated in certain days, which makes the heavy rainfall heavier, the so-called when it rains, it will pour. But we will at the same time have longer days that has no rainfall. So even though the total rainfall will increase, we will have longer days with little or light rainfall days. And those days are exactly the days you will experience more air pollution if the emissions are the same. So that was the mechanism we used to explain our hypothesis that global warming will lead to heavier pollutions.
Yang, have we seen a significant reduction in aerosols over China? Do we have measurements to show that this is actually happening?
If we look at the China locally, especially the northern China, there has been local measurements showing after 2013, the air pollution level is actually going down. And that is likely due to the local regulation and strong actions on this. If we only see air pollution level going down in 1 year, maybe that's just due to the year-to-year variability of meteorology. But once we have seen more than 5 years, a relatively longer trend of decline, people have done model experiment to suggest that cannot be explained by meteorology alone, and that has to be due to the local regulations. So in that sense, that has been very encouraging that the local government are doing the right thing and the action is now paying off. But in terms of global warming, that's not a very good news. Remember, the quicker reduction of air pollution will actually lead to more global warming. And those numbers are currently underestimated in even the latest IPCC reports, which are based on the earlier projection for the future. But now newer numbers are showing government are doing a faster and better job in cleaning up the air.
So are your research results specific to China, or can we apply these lessons in any country with air pollution, or does the work have to be redone, say, for North America or for Europe?
The general methodology can be easily transferred to any places. I have also done work related to South Asia using similar methodology because it is very unclear whether they will repeat the pathway of development like East Asia or they will take a cleaner pathway. If India is repeating the pathway of East Asia development, then their emission will go up and go down in the future. If they are alternatively taking a clean pathway, then we will actually see quicker warming due to the less pollution over South Asia. For North America and Europe, it's less a problem. The haze problem is not as severe as in Asian countries, but there are also problems at city level. In terms of research tools, people have developed numerical models specifically targeting urban environment using very high-resolution modeling tools so they can provide prescription to local problems.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. With me is Dr. Yangyang Xu from Texas A&M University. We are talking about how air pollution changes in a warming world, with China mainly as our case study. Yangyang, would you talk to us about the relationship between air pollution and extreme rainfall events, say in the past 30 years, and then what is expected in the future?
Yes. We had a new study exactly on this topic. This is a very difficult problem because it is very unclear about the relationship between aerosol and the extreme rainfall. There are basically some competing factors going on. Some people have suggested aerosol will trigger the convective rainfall, which is leading to the most extreme form of precipitation, therefore playing an enhancement in the flooding event. But our study have also suggested aerosol can lead to surface cooling, and that reduce the water vapor evaporation from the ocean and therefore reduce the tendency to have heavier rainfall. This is a very important question because the public will remember those extreme events, not global mean temperature or even regional mean climatology conditions, and how to predict and attribute the extreme event is an ongoing effort for climate scientists overall. And our contribution here is to suggest the long-term observed record of extreme rainfall trend, which is a very heterogeneous distribution regionally. We have drying in South Asia, the wetting in South China, and the drying in North China. This highly heterogeneous spatial pattern can only explain by the aerosol forcing in the last 30 years, which is fastly increasing. And we cannot explain this spatial pattern if we only look at the global warming simulation or looking at the natural variability itself.
Does smog or haze cool the nearby oceans, and is that significant?
Yes, that was exactly the mechanism we proposed to explain the long-term rainfall trend. Because of the solar radiation reduction, the air pollution overall will cool the ocean surface and reduce the moisture transport from the ocean into the continent, which is the source of water vapor producing heavy rainfall. This is happening for South Asia as well as East Asia.
We recently learned from a German database that China is either building or financing new coal plants in many countries, including in their Belt and Road project. How critical are coal emissions specifically to the overall load of aerosols in the air?
Coal emission is a major source of SO2 or sulfur emission for China. So that's a very dirty source of energy. However, we can also see there is an initiative going on in energy infrastructure, even though we have clear evidence of coal emission will lead to air pollution and also health issues. But the energy sectors are keep doing that. Not only in China, there are also recent proposals even in North Europe to build new coal power plant. So that's very depressing, I can say that.
Yes. Getting back to the point that you raised about extreme precipitation events, the IPCC released a special report saying that there would be more extreme precipitation events as the world heats up. I was wondering if that extra rain, would it wash out even more pollution or not?
Yes, this is getting back to the conversation we had early on about why global warming can actually make air pollution worse. This is a bit counterintuitive because global warming we'll have more water vapor available and therefore more rainfall. So intuitively, more rainfall will lead to a more effective wet removal and therefore a cleaner atmosphere. But our modeling studies last year have shown the opposite. As I have explained early, the total rainfall increase will mainly occur in certain heavier rainfall days. The other days with less rainfall or light rainfall will actually become more frequent. So in those days, air pollution will be very easy to build up in the atmosphere. So if you look at the long-term average, it is exactly the opposite. The rainfall increase overall will actually lead to a smaller efficiency of wet removal and therefore heavier pollution problem.
Life is strange. Okay, now in the winters of 2013, 2015, and 2016, China experienced something like smog storms, we could call it. An industry had to be shut down, car traffic was slashed. How do those air quality emergencies develop, and do you expect them to continue appearing in the future?
Yeah, if you look at individual hazy episodes, that has been due to both the emission from the local sources as well as certain meteorological conditions that are favorable of keeping the pollution locally instead of spreading it out to the Pacific Ocean. I haven't done any detailed studies on that, but my speculation is those events will continue in the next 5 to 10 years. And the longer beyond that, the local regulation will pay off and we will see those events going down.
As you know, some parts of the Earth are heating up more than others. For example, the Arctic is warming faster than North America generally. And an Indian expert on Radio EcoShock told us India is already 1.5 degrees warmer over most of the country for most of the year. Now, China is a large land mass, and it has several subregions. Is the forecast for heating over China different than global average figures?
Yeah, for sure. Global numbers is not universally true for everywhere. As you mentioned, certain regions are more sensitive to global warming, such as polar regions. China overall, the warming numbers so far and the future projection is not very different from global numbers because it's in the mid-latitude region that has a large domain. But certain regions in China, such as the plateau regions in Tibet, is known to be very sensitive to global warming because of the elevation. And this has a lot of downstream effects for river hydrology and fresh water.
It would be ironic if humans stopped polluting the air with our sun-reflecting sulfates, but then we feel forced to spray more sulfates in the Arctic or in the stratosphere to cool the planet back down. Do you think geoengineering will be necessary?
I would see that as a potential option that we can deploy if that's the only thing we're left. But this will be an emergency option. So far, there are only numerical modeling work to demonstrate the efficiency and the potential negative consequence of those so-called geoengineering schemes. There are no large-scale in-situ experiment to test out any of this. So, yeah, I would see that as a last resort.
Yang Shu, what motivated you as a student to become an atmospheric scientist?
Oh, that's a good question. I studied physics when I was an undergraduate student, and later on, I want to do something more related to the real world and also potentially benefiting the society. That's what motivated me to switch to atmospheric and the climate sciences, and I'm very happy about that, and I'm working hard daily to pursue that goal.
You must be, for the number of papers you put out. It's hard to imagine how you have a life, you work so hard. But as we finish up here, is there anything else you would like to tell our listeners?
I really appreciate the opportunities to speak through your program to the listeners. I would see without public support, none of the climate research can be conducted. And also without public support, all the scientific results are not really useful. It has to be through communication to the public and also the further communication through public.
I totally agree. From Texas A&M University, we have been talking with Dr. Yang-Yang Shu. He is the lead author in the new paper, Global Warming Will Happen Faster Than We Think, as published in the journal Nature. He is an expert in the relationships between air pollution in China and climate change. Find links to the science in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Yang-Yang, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
Terrible droughts driven by climate change can increase greenhouse gas emissions in a way you wouldn't expect. When the reservoirs at electric power dams run low, utilities make up the difference by burning more fossil fuels. In a new case study of the American West, the extra emissions are significant. This is just one part of the big story emerging as the world warms. Our guest is a drought specialist from Stanford University's Department of Earth System Science. Julio Herrera Estrada is a postdoctoral scholar with published research on droughts in Mexico, the United States, and Africa. Julio, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much, Alex. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about your recent paper, Response of Electricity Sector Air Pollution Emissions to Drought Conditions in the Western United States. That was published December 21st, 2018, in Environmental Research Letters. First of all, how do CO2 emissions from the electricity sector figure in the overall total of U.S. greenhouse gas emissions, say compared to cars or all the other uses we have?
In the U.S., the power sector produces around a third of the total emissions from all the sectors. Globally, this number is, I think, closer to a quarter, so 25% of all emissions, as best as we understand it, tend to come from the power sector.
So it really matters what happens in that sector. And Julio, what happens when giant power dams lose water capacity during a drought?
So we find that when we have less capacity of hydropower, for example, and even all the power plants as well, like natural gas and nuclear, because of a drought, you see an increase in generation with natural gas and coal. And the point is that in the U.S. especially, you know, people want to make sure that when they turn on the switch, like the light will turn on. Right. And so in order to have that level of reliability, there needs to be a lot of backup generation. And here, the backup generation is coal and natural gas, depending on the state. So again, when hydropower runs dry or nuclear power decreases or other type of electricity generation is affected by a drought, natural gas or coal power plants will come online to make sure that electricity keeps flowing into people's homes and, you know, help produce products and industry and whatnot. So that will lead to an increase in CO2 emissions from the power sector.
And let's say we have a big drought in the western United States. How much of a difference would it make that they had to kick in the natural gas generators or turn on the coal?
In our study, we studied the data record that we had from 2001 to 2015. So the advantage of that is that we draw our conclusions directly from observations. The drawback is that if there was not a big drought in a given year, in this time period in a given state, we might not be able to measure the response of the electricity sector in that state. So in this time period, 2001 to 2015, we especially saw important droughts occurring in the West Coast of the U.S., California, Washington, Oregon. And for those states specifically, we see an increase of about 10% in their emissions during drought years.
So it's not just hydroelectric power plants that are affected, as you said in your papers. I mean, fossil fuel plants need water for cooling, and even nuclear power plants need water for cooling. And if that water isn't available or it's too hot, they've got to shut down. So drought can affect that second stage of power production as well.
That's correct.
And what do your studies and the IPCC say about the evolution of drought for the coming decades? As the Earth warms, what are the overall predictions?
Yes, it's a good question. Again, it depends on the region. For the Western U.S., we tend to be experiencing drying, at least from the the soil perspective, the soil moisture perspective. So that's particularly important for agriculture and for vegetation. From the electricity generation side of things, the question is a bit trickier on one hand, because not all the models have consistent projections in terms of what's going to happen to rainfall and to runoff, which is the important variable to look at for recharge of rivers, which again are important for electricity generation. Having said that, with a warmer world, we're going to see decreasing snowpack, having more precipitation come down as rain instead of snow. And so that is going to affect, at least in the western U.S., the generation during the spring and summer season, since there's going to be less snowmelt happening throughout the spring and into the summer that will help continue replenish the reservoirs. We might start seeing more rapid, you know, sort of rainfall events, again, because of this effect that you mentioned of the atmosphere being able to hold more capacity, and as well as the effect of temperature that makes it fall as rainfall instead of snowfall. So electricity in the future might have a, in the western U.S., have it less reliable supply from hydro in the spring and summer months in the future.
And it seems like there's been a lot of severe droughts in the U.S. in the last 10 years. We had the 2011 drought in Texas, one in the U.S. Central Great Plains in 2012, and that five-year monster in California from 2012 to 2017. Is that normal, Julio, historically, say, or are we already experiencing the impact of climate change?
That's a good question. We are definitely already experiencing the impact. I mean, on one hand, drought is normal. We normally especially define drought as below normal water availability. And so that means, because of that definition, that's a relative to the normal, that a drought can happen everywhere, and even in semi-arid regions. But what we're seeing, especially in the U.S. and the western U.S., is more prolonged droughts. And I'm not a particular expert in this subject, but there is also an understanding that this is part of a bigger mega drought of the western U.S. We've basically had a drought in the western U.S. for the last few decades, or a decade more or less. And so that's, again, not out of the long-term record, completely out of the ordinary, but it is more likely that we're having these type of large and long-lasting droughts because of climate change. Again, in large part because of this warming trend that increases evapotranspiration and offsets changes in rainfall that may be helping alleviate some of the drought.
And the news is full of mixed messages about drought in Africa. The Sahel is drying up, one says, while another talks about the future greening of Sahara. So I'm a little mixed up about it. Julio, you have studied African droughts. Is there a big picture developing there?
Yes, one of the things that makes it complicated to study drought in Africa and in other developing regions is a decreasing number of observations from the ground. We have fewer and fewer stations, hydrometeorological stations on the ground reporting, and relatively short records. So in terms of identifying trends, that makes it hard. And part of the reason for why we're starting to see in some ways a greening of the area is because there was a big drought in the Sahel in the second half of the 20th century. And with satellite records, which kicked in around the end of the 1970s, beginning of the 1980s, we are looking at the recovery of the Sahel from those time periods, but it's a recovery from a long-lasting drought, if that makes sense. So it's not clear if that increasing trend is really more of a recovery or an actual increase, like long-term increasing trend. My understanding is that that region gets a lot of its water from the West African monsoon. And so there have been some studies that project a narrowing of the West African monsoon in terms of the time that it spans. If there's a delay in the onset or shorting in the end of the monsoon, that is going to have important implications for drought development in the region.
We're talking with Dr. Julio Herrera Estrada from Stanford. He researches the nature of droughts and their impacts on power generation and greenhouse gas emissions. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. In the plain language summary for your July 2017 paper, we find, quote, "After droughts have grown and become intense enough, they will tend to become even larger and more intense before conditions improve." Julio, please talk to us about that.
Yes, that was an interesting behavior that we found of the droughts that we were studying, and we found this relationship to be true globally. Basically, we were looking at droughts that were the order of a few hundred thousand square kilometers, and we found that when droughts become that large, the propensity is for those droughts to continue growing further. In the observations, again, this was a data-driven study, and where we identify the droughts, and then we see how the drought behaves after that. So we measured the probabilities of the droughts, you know, growing or shrinking, and ultimately we found that after the drought has reached those type of thresholds, area-wise and intensity-wise, the probability of the drought growing is higher than of the drought shrinking. So the drought will continue growing until it reaches again a turning point, and then it'll start alleviating.
So it can get worse before it gets better when you have a big one.
Yes, exactly. And you know, we still are in the process of studying why that might be. One of the hypotheses is that there are sort of positive feedbacks, vicious cycles, that, you know, when it's dry, there's less evaporation, and because there's less evaporation, there's less water in the atmosphere, that water vapor in the atmosphere, and therefore there's a lower chance of rain. So you have, because there's been a lower chance of rain, that there's a drier soil, and again, that's a vicious cycle in a way. So we are potentially thinking of an example of a mechanism for why we might see this event where the droughts become larger and larger and more intense before they start to recover.
There's some real worry out there about super droughts coming even from some of the best climate scientists. I mean, Dr. Jonathan Overpeck back in 2005 raised the question of whether we were at the dawn of a super interglacial drought, as he called it. And then we had that February 2015 issue of Science Advances with Benjamin Cook and his co-authors. The title of the paper was Unprecedented 21st Century Drought Risk in the American Southwest and Central Plains. They suggest mega droughts worse than even happened in medieval times. What are your thoughts about all that?
Yeah, well, I mean, these are great researchers, and so they've asked really interesting questions. And the really interesting thing about the research is that they put the current droughts in the perspective of the paleo record, looking at, you know, hundreds, thousands of years, how normal or what's the probability of having droughts like the ones that we see today. So in terms of the science aspect of it, I think it's still an active area of research, understanding what are the drivers of these mega droughts, understanding what caused them in the past, and if those mechanisms are becoming stronger in a definite way in the current climate. But from the other side, from the what do we do about it, I think it's also important to not get crippled by the, you know, potential uncertainty that we have in some of these projections.
I recently interviewed Dr. Victor, and it was a recent comment in the journal Nature by Shu Ramanathan and Victor, talking about three reasons global warming will be worse than previously thought. And one factor they pinpointed was a natural warming cycle coming out of interdecadal changes in ocean heat, mainly in the Pacific, but also changes in Atlantic mixing. Well, here's a rather simple question, but if a part of the world stays in a drought so long that it seems permanent, when does a drought become a desert?
For example, I mean, even the UN has the two terms are, you know, drought and desertification. And as you mentioned, in some cases, a drought might really show a bigger trend underneath it. Like a drought is normally defined, as I mentioned, as in some ways like a temporary deviation from what normal conditions are. As I said, everywhere experiences drier water conditions from time to time. And so the drought is the drier side. However, we start seeing a drying trend over a period of multiple years that just doesn't recover. That's what we start just calling desertification. And while some of the processes that are involved in both of these events, the droughts and desertification, might be similar, overall they're also very different processes. Because in one case, for example, for a drought, for example, a high pressure system that's preventing, you know, rainfall from reaching a given area. But if we have desertification, that shows a broader change in the latitude, for example, of pressure systems overall. It's not just a temporary pressure system that, you know, happened to be parked here, if that makes sense. It's part of a bigger long-term change that may be associated with this interdecadal variability that we see coming from the ocean, for example.
And from what you've seen, should we expect drought to significantly affect future food production?
I think so. And I think one thing that's also emerging is the study of the impact of droughts in different places at the same time, right? So if we have a drought in the U.S., but overall good conditions throughout the world, our global food trade network allows us to mitigate some of that, you know, shock to the food market. But if we start having multiple droughts simultaneously in different places, that might be important for our food supply globally. And, you know, that will be reflected in prices of commodities and food. And going back to what we mentioned at the beginning, with a higher temperature, there's a higher likelihood in general of a dry year becoming a drought year from the agricultural side of things.
What do you see as the remaining frontiers for scientific exploration of drought?
I think one aspect that we mentioned towards the end of one of my papers about how droughts move is precisely that we haven't studied thoroughly the movement or like how droughts behave in space and time simultaneously. We tend to focus on, for example, how a drought in California evolves, but that is a very limited picture. We need to broaden the view and understand how droughts in North America behave to understand how a drought in California might end up in the Midwest, for example. By studying that more, we can, and the drivers of that, it will hopefully also be allow us to predict droughts better in the future. And one thing that I also mentioned, should also mention is there is also a lot of work to be done in terms of understanding and characterizing drought risk, security, threats from droughts, because the impact of drought on agriculture is an obvious one. But the impact of drought on energy, or the impact of drought on the wastewater treatment sector, or how drought affects water utilities in general from a financial standpoint, those are questions that we haven't really asked much to in terms both of the science of drought as well as the impact of drought on the economy.
From Stanford University, we've been talking with the rising drought specialist, Dr. Julio Herrera Estrada. Julio is the lead author in the paper Responsive Electricity Sector Air Pollution Emissions to Drought Conditions in the Western United States. You can find links to this and to Julio's website in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Julio, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Alex. It was a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. You can help educate everyone you know and the world by forwarding links to the Radio EcoShock shows and interviews. Help me get the voice of scientists out as far as we can. Get it at ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening, and let's do it again next week.